It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power with Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My name is Mark Gillar. I'll be your host as we interview Dr. James Hannum. He holds a physics degree from Oxford as well as a PhD in history and philosophy of science from Cambridge. Most importantly to us today, he is the author of The Genesis of Science, How the Christian Middle Ages Launched the Scientific Revolution. This book was shortlisted for the Royal Society Prize for Science Books in 2010. James has also written for various magazines and newspapers, including The Spectator, History Today, Standpoint, and New Scientist. He lives in Kent, England, with his wife and two children. Dr. Hannum, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I have to say that I've already given one copy of the book away to a friend, so you've gotten at least one additional sale out of me.
Thank you. I hope you both enjoy it.
I know that we will, and I've already gotten into the book. I'll be honest, I haven't finished it, but it's very enjoyable, and I got about one chapter in, and I immediately thought of a friend of mine who was moving away, and I gave him a copy of the book at his going away party, and the first thing he said to me was, I'm very familiar with Dr. Hannum, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. This is going to make for very enjoyable reading. So I've already got one happy customer success story for you.
Thank you very much.
We haven't even gone on the air with it yet, so we're one ahead of the game. Now, one of the things I'll say, Dr. Hannum, is that whenever one discusses the history of the church and science in the same conversation, people will be very quick to tell you that they believe the church does not have a very good track record with regard to science. They will tell you that they'll bring up the story of Galileo, and then they'll probably eventually dive into how many of us as Catholics feel about stem cell research, and tell you that the church, if nothing else, has impeded the progress of science. But based on your book, that's not really true, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think the church has basically been a positive influence on science for quite a number of reasons. And it's quite remarkable that there is this general idea that the church and Christianity have held back the rise of science. I think that's quite wrong. You mentioned Galileo, and it is true that Galileo was put on trial officially for saying that the Earth goes around the sun as a fact rather than a hypothesis. But when you look at the actual circumstances behind that trial, you find that, in fact, what had happened was he had insulted the Pope by ridiculing an argument that the Pope had made on the subject. And the Pope was outraged about this. It wasn't something in those days you could get away with being rude to the Pope, and so he demanded that Galileo was put on trial to teach him a lesson. Very unfortunate thing to have happened, and reflects badly on the church, but it wasn't really about science, and I think it's quite unfair that all the positive things that the church has done for science over the centuries have been completely overshadowed by this one misunderstood event.
So it was really more of a political situation than a scientific.
Yes, I think that's the case. It is widely known that during the Renaissance of the 16th century, popes were like princes, really. They ruled over a large amount of land. They jockeyed for position with the crowned heads of Europe. And dealing with the papacy was a political thing as much as a religious thing. Galileo was not a very good politician. Many historians have said that if he had been a little bit more subtle, and had played his cards rather better, the whole tragedy of his being put on trial would probably never have happened.
Now, you mentioned in the book that medieval craftsmen not only made discoveries of their own, but also seized upon Eastern invention and improved them. Give us some examples of this.
Well, I think one very good example of that is printing. Printing originally came from the Far East and gradually moved into Europe during the 14th and 15th centuries, but it was in Europe in Germany, that printing was, if you like, perfected, turned into an industry which was able to completely revolutionize the spread of learning. And if you compare the way that books were prepared in Europe using movable metal type, extremely well-lasting ink, paper was used, that was another Eastern invention that was readily taken up in Europe, you find that the book as a whole, printing, was turned into this fantastically efficient knowledge storing and knowledge spreading package, which somehow just never seemed to happen in the Far East.
I think you mentioned at one point in the book that you felt that was in fact a more significant development than the development of gunpowder. Perhaps I'm misquoting it.
No, I think that probably is the case. I think that a printed book caused an explosion of knowledge and the spread of knowledge. And although gunpowder, another recent invention which was used to produce reliable handguns in Europe where they had never really existed in the Far East, it's a hugely significant thing for human history. Ultimately, I think that knowledge and science has proved to be more powerful than the sword.
Absolutely. And let me point to one quote from the book. You essentially had said that the Catholic Church led directly to the development of modern science. That seems a rather bold statement. Back that up.
Well, one of the things that the Church did during the Middle Ages was to make science compulsory at the new universities which were founded in Europe at the time. And the reason it did that was that it thought, correctly in my view, that science was the study of God's creation. And therefore, if you were studying nature, you were studying the work of God. And that made it tremendously important as far as the Church was concerned. And we tend to forget, because there's so much what we call applied science and technology around, that up until the 19th century, science wasn't really a practical subject at all. It didn't really have any practical applications. Technology and invention was something which didn't have any links to what academic science. So by giving this religious reason for studying nature, for studying science, the Church gave people a really good reason to do it that they may not have had otherwise. And it thought that it was so important and so useful that if you wanted to, for example, go on to become a theologian, the study of theology, of course, being the queen of the sciences as far as the Church is concerned, you had to have mastered natural science and mathematics in advance.
How have we reached the point today where science is so secular? It's almost as if religion is looked down upon by many within the scientific community. What brought us to this point?
Well, I think that it's been useful to suggest that science and religion have been in conflict for people with certain kinds of agendas. And I think because science is now today so respected and so successful, if you want to try and downgrade the importance of religion, then you try and contrast it with science. And I think that that way of thinking has become very pervasive in the scientific community. I think it's wrong, and I know a great number of very good scientists who are also extremely religious men and women, but it is the case that I think the culture within science has become rather inward-looking, if I can put it that way.
Ben Stein, somewhat of a all-around American popular figure, did a movie called Expelled, where he looked at the treatment that a scientist would receive if they embraced intelligent design, for example. And, of course, we see it also with the man-made global warming theory. It would seem that within the scientific community, free thought isn't that valued. In fact, there seems to be more of a herd mentality, and I feel that this secular view is part of that. Am I off base?
Well, I have to say that I'm a Darwinist. I tend to agree with the Pope on this question that evolution is true. I don't support intelligent design, but I certainly don't support trying to silence debate in the way that has been happening in the United States. I recall recently an astronomer who had been rejected by the University of Kentucky received an out-of-court settlement of over $100,000 because he had been discriminated on the grounds that he was a Christian. And I think that's very unfortunate, and it really does reflect badly on the scientific profession as a whole if they don't keep an open mind and they don't support debate, even when they think that the people they're debating are wrong.
I think one priest that I'm aware of perhaps put it best when he said, if you're capable of believing that God created man through evolution, then there is no conflict. Is that the position you take?
Yes, absolutely. I think that if you like, God set the ground rules, and he then allowed the universe its own freedom and integrity to develop along the lines which he envisaged, but still allowing it to be something which was separate from himself rather than something which he was required to fiddle and adjust from time to time in order to keep it on the right track. I think intelligent design suggests that if he has to step in and make corrections, that means he maybe wasn't such a great designer in the first place, and I think theologically that's not a satisfactory idea.
Very good. Now, let's talk about the Middle Ages for a moment. And before we do that, though, you make the point in your book that taking groups of years and classifying them as the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, not entirely the best way to go about it.
I don't think it is, because I think people just get ideas into their head about particular periods and then tend to ignore the details of what that period was actually like. So the Renaissance, the rebirth, that sounds fantastic, but it suggests that what came before was some kind of, you know, cultural death from which you had to be reborn. The Enlightenment suggests that people living before that time were living in darkness, as of course the Dark Ages expresses as well. And I don't find that helpful, and I think it's very unfair on the people who lived during that time that they're being written off or exalted simply on the basis of one-word descriptions.
I remember as a small child hearing about the Dark Ages and wondering if they were in some sort of a permanent eclipse.
Well, nowadays we watch Monty Python, and everybody is permanently covered in mud. The vision of the Middle Ages for many people nowadays.
Absolutely, yes. They're quite the success on both sides of the pond, as you know. Now, speaking of the Medieval Ages, well, one of the things that we often hear is that during the Middle Ages, we had people believing that the Earth was flat. Not true, you say in your book.
Not true at all. During the Middle Ages, as far as we know, nobody thought the Earth was flat. It was something which was widely known that the Earth is a sphere. The Church certainly never taught that the Earth is flat. And it's one interesting example of how well known it was that the Earth is a sphere is that when a medieval king was crowned, as still happens today in England with the Queen of England, they were presented with an orb as a symbol of their earthly power. And the reason it was an orb was it was shaped of the Earth. And presumably, if people thought that the Earth was flat, they would have handed them a dinner plate instead.
That's very funny. Now, let me ask you another question regarding myths, since we've already shot one down. What do you think is the biggest myth about religion's relationship to science that people still believe today?
Well, I think the big myth, if you like, is the idea that Christianity held back the rise of science. And actually a myth that is very odd, and it's because when you think about it, the only part of the world where modern science has ever arisen is in Christian Western Europe. It never happened in ancient Greece. It didn't happen in the Islamic world. It didn't happen in ancient China, in India, or anywhere else at all. And yet, in this part of the world, this small and at the time not particularly significant part of the world, which was Christian, modern science arose really quite quickly. It developed through the Middle Ages and then flowered amazingly from the 17th century onwards. And you would think that if Christianity was somehow a disadvantage for science, that could never have happened. It would have been an absolutely unheard of event that if science was incompatible with the most powerful cultural force of Europe, then it would have actually arisen in Europe and not anywhere else. So I think that it's very strange that people do imagine that the church held back science. If the church was holding back science, science would not have happened. It's as simple as that.
Do you think it's just one more excuse for people who wish to attack the church?
Well, I think it's a very useful myth for the new atheists to have. They want to annex science for themselves, if you see what I mean. They want its prestige for their to be tacked on to their atheist views. So they do tend to push this idea that Christianity had held back science, that Christianity was the enemy of science, because that helps them to push their own ideological agendas.
Well, I know in the States, politically speaking, the left and the right constantly accuse each other of hijacking science. And that kind of leads me into the next question. Why do you feel our government is so highly involved in scientific funding at this time?
Well, I think partly it's the view that there are things that science can achieve that they want to be able to get the credit for. If, for example, when a man was put on the moon, which was a great technological and scientific achievement, that actually did rub off quite well on the president of the time, Richard Nixon. And so it is a case of, I think, where the government sees something which is terribly successful, it wants to step in and it wants to get some of the stardust, if you like, from that success to rub onto itself.
Well, there certainly is a lot of scientific funding, and of course in the States right now it seems like there's a tremendous amount of funding behind man-made global warming. I think the stimulus package that President Obama signed into law early in his first term here, it was something like $6 billion in that direction. So the trend certainly continues. Now, give me just one second. Now, medieval inventors helped lay the groundwork for many of today's most commonly used objects. Can you give us some examples?
Well, I'm wearing one at the moment. Eyeglasses, spectacles were invented around about 1300 in Italy, and something, of course, we completely take for granted. And we never think of them as being a medieval invention. And they were revolutionary important because they could correct long-sightedness, and that had the effect of increasing the working life of pretty much anyone who had to do reading or writing for a living. And so it had been the case that if you became long-sighted, you could no longer read and write, then your professional career could have been over by the age of 40 or so. So it could increase the contribution that scholars were able to make quite markedly. At around the same time, the mechanical clock was invented. It's another medieval invention, that, I think, the automatic clock, which runs itself and keeps time, and something which was of fundamental importance to the technological and the industrial revolution, which developed in Europe over the following centuries.
What role did medieval science play in our modern advances in science, in technology, and in culture?
Well, if you were to read the sort of the classics of the scientific revolution, the books by Copernicus and by Galileo, which really form the foundations of modern science, we now know that they took an awful lot of their ideas from scholarship from the Middle Ages. And for a long time, nobody realized this. People thought that they had invented it all themselves. But in fact, Copernicus's arguments as to why we can't feel the Earth moving came straight out of a 14th century Parisian philosopher's works. Galileo's formulas for how objects fall under gravity were developed in medieval Oxford. And unfortunately, both of these authors, Galileo and Copernicus, really didn't tell people where they were getting their ideas from. And so that led for centuries to people who imagine there had been no scientific advances during the Middle Ages. And in fact, that's simply not the case at all. And they fed directly into the work of these pioneers of the scientific revolution and hence directly into modern science itself.
Are there any lost heroes of science during the medieval period whose names should be better known?
Well, I think there are several. Jean Buridan is probably the one who I would most like to be able to make better known. He was a philosopher at the University of Paris who died in around about 1350. And he was probably the greatest natural philosopher of the Middle Ages, and he did fantastic work on the science of mechanics, on astronomy. He developed a formulation for science of motion, which today we tend to call Newton's first law. But we could very nearly have called it Buridan's first law, because he says pretty much the same thing about how things will move that Newton says 300 years later. So I think he certainly does deserve to be much better known. I think part of the reason he's not so well known is we don't know very much about his life. So it's quite difficult to hook a story onto the name.
So did Newton develop his ideas independently, or do you think he actually drew upon the earlier work?
Well, Newton developed a huge amount of very important science, including calculus, and he was the first person to develop a rigorous mathematical description of how it is that objects move under universal gravitation, for instance. But Buridan's ideas that if an object is not subject to friction or force, it will keep moving forever, directly contradicts what Aristotle and the ancient Greeks had taught. And Buridan's idea fed through into later thinkers, it fed through into Galileo, and from Galileo it fed through into Newton. I doubt very much Newton had ever read a word of Jean Buridan, but we can now, because we have been finally able to read the books and manuscripts that followed out of the Middle Ages, we can see these ideas being traced through, and we can make fairly direct links between Jean Buridan and Isaac Newton.
Is it something that occurs often in science that the wrong person gets the credit? I mean, we've often been told, of course, that Benjamin Franklin didn't really invent or discover electricity. We've been told the Wright brothers didn't really invent the airplane. And it seems like we're constantly hearing that the people we most often attribute with certain discoveries aren't the ones who deserve the credit. Is that common within the world of science?
Well, I think it is reasonably common, I think, because what really counts is not who does something first, but who makes something public first. That's the guy who usually gets the credit. But I think that although you mentioned Benjamin Franklin, you mentioned the Wright brothers, they had very considerable achievements. Franklin was an important experimental scientist of his time. The Wright brothers' powered flight actually was a really substantial step forward. So I don't think we have to suggest that they didn't achieve anything just because we've got a slightly better understanding of what came before them.
Very good. Now, let's bust a few more myths. Another myth out there is that the Inquisition executed people for their scientific ideas. True or false?
That's false. I'm very pleased to say that the Inquisition never burned anybody at the stake or executed them for scientific ideas. It's one of the great ironies of history, actually, that the only great scientist ever to be executed was Anton Lavoisier, the father of modern chemistry. He was guillotined during the French Revolution by the avowedly anti-Christian Jacobins. In fact, so it was anti-Christians who were the only ones who ever executed a great scientist. The Inquisition, I don't think we want to downplay that it's absolutely hideous and wrong to persecute people for their religious beliefs, let alone burn them at the stake. But the Inquisition itself was an institution that used legal methods which were actually quite in advance of their time. At the time the Inquisition began in the 13th century, criminal law was something which was really just based on your reputation. If you were accused of something, you just got a load of people to say you're a good guy, so you can't have done it, or else you could have gone by trial, by ordeal, but evidence just didn't really come into the question. So when the Pope started the Inquisition, he said that we're going to have a specialist magistrate whose job it is to go out, investigate crimes, weigh up the evidence, and come to a conclusion. And that actually, I think, is in fact a much better way of investigating crime than the methods that were used in secular courts at the time. The Inquisition as a method of criminal investigation was so successful that it is still today the foundation of criminal law throughout continental Europe.
One of the things that we hear about when we hear of the church perhaps in some way impeding scientific progress is that the church somehow prevented the dissection of the human body or the boiling of bodies. Set the record straight on that.
Well, it's very interesting that there has been this very widespread taboo against dissecting human bodies for scientific research. The ancient Greeks didn't do it. The Romans didn't do it. The Islamic world didn't do it. It's quite remarkable that when it began in medieval Europe, the church did not mind.
Really?
It didn't mind. In fact, some of the earliest dissections were ordered by the Pope himself as criminal autopsies or to investigate the causes of plague. So, there is, in fact, a slight grain of truth behind the idea that the church tried to stop human dissection, because the church said that if you were a crusader who was killed in the Holy Land, you were supposed to be buried where you fell. You shouldn't try and ship the body home. And what they were doing was boiling bodies in order to render the flesh off and then ship the bones home to be buried in the family tomb. For one reason or another, the church decided that they didn't like this. But that, in fact, was not used as a reason to prevent human dissection. It was simply something that much later on people imagined was evidence for their preconceived belief that the church was objecting to human dissection. But it never happened. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, for Vesalius, the great dissectionist of the 16th century, there was a rumor that he'd been put on trial by the Inquisition and sent to his death on a pilgrimage. And again, there's no actual evidence for that at all. It's just that once people believe something and they start looking for evidence for their preconceived beliefs, they will start to believe anything which agrees with their prejudices. There's a ridiculous story that one pope tried to excommunicate Halley's Comet. That's utterly ridiculous, but it's so widely believed. Or the pope tried to ban zero. Why on earth would a pope try to ban zero? And yet a professor of chemistry at Oxford put this in a book of his just a few years ago.
Wow. So the misinformation continues.
Unfortunately, yes. I hope my book will go some way to correcting that balance.
Now, do you see yourself as the successor to Carl Sagan in that you are putting together scientific material in such a way that the layperson can appreciate it?
Well, I have a lot of time for Carl Sagan's work, and as a boy, as I was when he was doing Cosmos, I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book. But coming back to his writing as a historian and a grown up, I have to say that he was an extremely bad historian, and many of the myths that we've been talking about are there in his books. Including others that we haven't talked about, and that's very unfortunate. I don't think that should detract from his achievement in helping people understand science, but do not go near him for history.
I appreciate the warning. I was a boy, too, while I was in high school, whenever Cosmos aired on television, and I can remember the excitement, the buzz that it caused, and whatever his historical inaccuracies might have been, and now that you're mentioning it, I guess I recall a few myself. He did manage to get young people very excited about science, and I think that was, in fact, a very good thing. I can recall everyone talking about it at school, many of us subscribing to his magazine. And like you, I suppose many that followed that path also recognized the errors that he made and some of his historical inaccuracies. But I think he did a very good thing in that he excited the lay community to the wonderful world of science.
Well, I agree, and he was a scientist, so that was what he was good at. Perhaps things go wrong when you step out of your own area of expertise, but actually I think it's good that people are interested in outside their own area of expertise, and as we said earlier, perhaps science today is a little bit too inward-looking and could do with looking at other subjects slightly more.
Now, in reading your bio, I saw where you were quite successful in the area of financing films. What was it that made you go back to school, pursue advanced degrees, and pursue this area of research?
Well, I put basically it was just a passion for the subject. I had absolutely no doubt at all that this was what I really, really wanted to do, and I had the opportunity. I was lucky enough to get a place at Cambridge, and I just thought, well, there's no way that I'm going to turn down a chance like that. So I think if you are truly passionate about something, then that's what you should be doing.
They say the secret to life is to find something you enjoy doing and then figure out a way to make a living at it. So
yes, not always easy. I still work in business as well as doing writing.
Well, speaking of business, let's try to make a few cash registers ring. Tell my listeners how they can get a hold of a copy of your book.
Well, it should be available in plenty of bookstores. It's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Kindles, BookNooks. So it should not be too difficult to find if anybody is interested in reading it. And I should emphasize that it's not an academic book. It's a book for general readers, and it doesn't assume any kind of background knowledge in the Middle Ages or anything like that.
I am not a scientist. I am enjoying the book very much, and I can certainly back you up on that particular point. Whether you have a background in science or, as you said, the medieval time period, really doesn't matter. It's a very enjoyable read, so I would encourage everyone out there to pick up a copy. As I said at the onset, I've already given a copy to a friend, and he was very, very pleased by the gift. So everyone go to Amazon.com. I know it's also being stacked in the local Barnes & Noble, so I'm sure it is elsewhere, and pick up a copy of this. Dr. Hannum, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. Please give our best to your wife in her recovery, and we look forward to having you back on the show again sometime soon.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Fantastic. Have a great day.
Good morning.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.